work at Harvard during starting at age 40, and I gradually became more accepted in that society. In fact, just before I turned 50, I was elected as a member of the National Academy of Sciences, which was I was at Harvard, and by 50 I was a member of MIS. And this, in turn, influenced my life in various ways, which I will get to. One of the things of Harvard was and is that the most competent students were attracted to Harvard. And I very competent graduate students who chose to work with me after I had become a professor at Harvard. And this was very...
Something, I'm sorry, there's something not behaving itself. And so let's try that.
Okay, keep going.
Well, I was talking about that I was elected to the National Academy, which again was an event that influenced my life. I enjoyed being associated with my colleagues at Harvard, but after I was elected to the Academy, I guess I even more enjoyed being associated with my colleagues at the National Academy. And in fact, they began to think of me not only as scientists, but as somebody who was interested in the real world, and asked me initially to join the finance committee of the Academy. And I had that experience. I was nominated as treasurer of the Academy and was re-elected 2 times, remaining as treasurer for the maximum number of years, namely 12, that one could do that. This service as treasurer reinforced my interest in finance, and allowed me to do some things at Harvard which were unusual. One of those things was to set up a company in which some academic colleagues joined me. In 1974, we set up the company, and we looked for a name for it, and we thought of, or I thought of, the possibility of naming it CHON, being the acronym for carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, and nitrogen. And CHON Corporation was born, and the idea was that John would look in the academic world for projects that had the possibility of becoming commercially relevant, and give the academic people a chance to participate in this commercial development as a result of their own research. Well, we had a very good board of directors who ran the company. I was the president, but Bob Woodward was on the board. And several other people. I won't say equal academic status, but of equal interest. The company really was founded at a time when most academic people did not have industrial connections, and so they welcomed its finding. At the same time, I set up John as a potential industrial profit-making organization. I also set up another organization while at Harvard at the same time, which was non-profit. This company, which I organized, was called Bay Biochemical Research, and indicated my interest not only in biochemistry, but also my interest in marine life.
Which bay was it referring to?
The bay was Pleasant's Bay. Biochemical research.
If that was not for profit, was it seeking NIH grants?
Yes, it did.
Yes. CHOM. I mean, that sounds like biotech before biotech was invented.
That's right. We were really foresighted.
And did it? How did it fare?
It fared well in terms of stimulating thinking among the academic professors, but we didn't have the real interest in making an industrial company. We didn't have the component and the dedication that is necessary for an organization of that kind to succeed. And it more or less was terminated after 10 years. It did some very interesting work, and it brought us in touch with a lot of interesting people, including Pierre Crabbe, who was a chemist at Syntex and was at that time working at UNESCO. As I look back on what I see is that there are connections between almost everything I did, although they're not obvious connections. I think the important point is that I wanted to keep doing things. And I was always looking for areas in either science or industry, or both, where I can make contributions.
If you're here in your 40s, how many hours a day, how many days a week were you working?
Well, I would work nights, and I would work weekends.
Mm-hmm.
I worked hard, enjoyed it, because I had another whole new world of people when I went to Harvard. And I felt strange, but eventually I was welcomed.
Well, you did. I mean, it wasn't just that you were chairman of the biological chemistry, because in due course you became Dean of Public Health. I mean,
yes, that's another part of my life at Harvard. But I became academic dean at the School of Public Health because I had a good friend, Howard Hyatt, who had taken on the job as dean. And, well, Howard is a brilliant person. He did not appreciate some of the professors at the School of Public Health, and in fact alienated some of them. And he needed somebody in the academic world who would relate more to the professors while he related more to other aspects of school life.
And you were actually making major scientific contributions yourself while all this was going on.
I was fortunate. Being recognized as a member of the National Academy, but also because I did other things related to science, such as creation of CHARM, creation of Bay Biochemical Research. That was not, they were not ordinary things. So, if I look at my life at Harvard, an aspect of it which developed from the Harvard experience was my life in Cambridge, in Washington, as a member of the National Academy of Sciences. Soon after I became treasurer in 1980, I became a member of the executive committee of the Council of the Academy, and I had the responsibility for chairing the Internal Affairs Committee and the Finance Committee of the National Academy.
What's the Internal Affairs Committee? It sounds like the Gestapo.
It is. It wasn't really that, but it was the committee concerned with making sure that what we did as an organization, as an academic organization, was appropriate.
Did that, was that controversial? That sounds very bland.
Well, it actually was a committee that at some level approved projects to be taken on by the National Academy. That's the major thing, though, that I did as a member of the Academy, was being treasurer as such. And it turned out that I was very comfortable with the president of the Academy at that time, Frank Press, and he and I had the self-appointed job of increasing the endowment of the Academy. When I became treasurer of the Academy, the endowment was $25 million, which was modest. The Academy relied on directives from the Congress and from other areas of government to do its work. Frank and I together decided that it would be useful if the Academy not only responded to what the government and the Congress wanted it to do, but could initiate projects on its own. To do that, realistically, the Academy needed additional income and this endowment. And that's why we set about increasing the endowment. When Frank and I, his term as officers ended, the endowment had gone from quintupled, and it was $125 million. And the Academy was able to take on projects that it really wanted to do, rather than waiting for the government to tell the Academy what it wanted the Academy to do.
How did you accomplish this simple feat?
Getting the 125. Well, it was working with people who thought the Academy had potential and were willing to put money in helping that potential become reality. Some of it were presidents of large corporations, other people who donated to the Academy's funds were leaders in the foundation world. So it was really sort of a satisfying thing to do.
It must have been a lot of visiting and calling to make that happen.
Well, it was, but we had, I was part of it, and Frank Press was very valuable. We had a great ally in Dr. Samuel Fear, who was president of the Institute of Medicine and was very verbal with people at foundations, and he helped us raise some of his funds. As you probably know, Sam Field, when he left the Academy, became president of Brandeis University, and most recently has been president of a large medical organization in Boston area named the Partners Group, the group of people who ran Mass General Hospital and Peter Bedford Hospital. So, again, I have known people who are not only intelligent but accomplished. And Sam Fear is in that category.
Were there one or two particular donors who were more important in this effort with the Academy?
Well, there were no major donors other than foundations and certain organizations, such as IBM, gave money. But as you mentioned, as I mentioned, it allowed me to associate with a very interesting group of people who are neither in the academic world as professors or in the industrial world, but were in between, in the foundation.
Part of the growth of the, how much of that growth in the investment was due to a better investment policy?
I'd say, you know, it was sort of the period when investment yielded dramatic results. And the growth in the endowment was roughly 50% due to donations, Excuse me. 50% to wise financial investment.
What was the key on that side of the street in terms of wise investment?
On that side of the street, it was the finance committee of the family who had the responsibility for making investments for the academy. And we worked with various advisors, finally finding a couple of dedicated young people who are most valuable.
But was the finance committee itself academic scientists? I mean, that's what the academy
from
is.
The academy. There were, but fortunately, in the finance committee, among the academic scientists, were two academic economists. One of whom was from Pennsylvania Wharton School. His name, I forget at the moment, but I will add it to this. And the second was from MIT. And he was a man I'd known for many years and had served on other committees. And he was Paul Samuelson. And he kept us on the right track in the philosophy of investing. It's interesting how things come around in life. When I was academic dean, one of Paul's sons finished medical school and wanted to work in public health. And I was influential in helping him get the right position. Mm-hmm. This is what happens in life all the time. Things you can't plan have unexpected consequences.
If the assets were growing, and you're chairing the Internal Affairs Committee, what ventures did you in fact launch or encourage as a result of this ability to be a little more independent?
Well, there were several. Among the most successful was as a result of the academic connections we had, we realized that AIDS was a problem, was going to be a problem to the world. And long before the National Institutes of Health recognize this, we at the National Academy sponsored a study with our own funds on AIDS and human immunodeficiency diseases. And it had a great deal of influence in convincing other people to get into the act there. But that was the kind of thing that we envisioned the academy could do, and the government was not ready to do it.
Knowing what you know, if you were absolute dictator, how would you have changed the academy?
Thank you. to Taylor, I would have increased its endowment even more than we were able to do. So the Academy's work, in larger part, would be independent of what the government thought was important. The relationship between the Academy and government is very close, but the Academy in the 80s had built up a large organization, and to supply the funds for that organization, it had to go to the government and stimulate them to ask the Academy to do things. It's an organizational arrangement that worked, but it too often resulted in the Academy being asked to do trivial things by the government. And not concentrated on major problems.
Would
you like some pine salad?
You're
doing well, honey.
Stop a second. Can you say something about the impact of the presidents in the Academy and the election and the kind of change of office that you've observed the Academy closely over time?
Yes, I'd be glad to. Frank Press, as I said, became a personal friend. In fact, I knew Frank when I lived in Belmont and he lived in Belmont. And when he was elected president of the Academy, it was natural that he would talk to me about some intimate things. Frank is a brilliant scientist, and as such, contributed a lot to the Academy. But in addition to being a brilliant scientist, he had a very good feeling of how an organization can be stimulated. And he spent a lot of his time in trying to, in a sense, reorganize the Academy, and especially its group, who presumably did work for the government, this group being the Council.
The National Research Council.
National Research Council. He was able to reorganize the National Research Council, but I'm not sure it accomplished what he hoped it would accomplish. And I'm not sure it is now accomplishing all it can.
His hope was what? To focus it more?
To have major projects. And to have projects that were not only suggested by the government, for it seems, but were national for international needs. It was very good to be able to not only relate to the National Research Council, for me as treasurer to work for that, but also for me as treasurer to be able to meet with people from sister academies, namely the Royal Society, the Soviet Academy of Sciences, and to a lesser extent some of the Chinese colleagues. This was not only work but also play. When we, for example, when we got to meet with the Royal Society, we were treated, quotes, royally, close to quotes, including either staying at a major university, Cambridge or Oxford, but also staying during some of our visits at a very interesting location, namely Leeds Castle.
Yes, I've been there. It's lovely, and
this was sort of a benefit that one got from being not only in the academy, but being an officer of the academy, and I'm grateful to it. Now to get to the question of our president, which is a leading figure in the academy, is selected. It's usually done by a committee, but with most, as, and these were committees composed of National Academy members, but with both, as with most committees, there are one or two, or the most three people who are the most useful, who are the most forceful, and who persuade the other members of the committee. It's a great honor to be president of the National Academy of Sciences, and it's not the sort of thing one applied for. Really, the nominating committee is charged with looking at the membership of the academy and seeing whether who among the members of the academy would make a suitable president after the 12-year term that I have and Frank Press has. Almost every member of the nominating committee had his own candidate, because it is such an honor. I argued that Frank Bress was a great scientist, and he did well as president of the academy, but I felt the academy was getting a little inbred, and we should look among our younger members for who could be the next person. I won't tell you who was suggested, but they were very competent people, and at a certain point it wasn't clear that who would get the nod, and I made a strong pitch at that point for a younger person, and in particular one whom I knew, Bruce Alberts. The committee finally agreed that it would be good, A, to have a younger person, and that Bruce was an intriguing possibility. And he was suggested. I think the nomination came out of the blue to him. It was not his hope or agenda that he be president of the Academy. But after a while, it became clear that he was more intrigued with that possibility, and he agreed to be nominated. I know Bruce as a student at Harvard, he was in the biophysics program. He actually did his degree with Paul Dovey, and Paul and I have been friends for 60 years, so I think we moved. I knew Bruce Alberts from the time he was a student till he was nominated as president of the Academy. It isn't clear whether he's going to be a great president yet. It is clear that he has grown, has been in his career as president, and that he did bring something to the Academy that was different, which was different from what Frank Press brought. He brought his experience and knowledge of molecular biology, and he brought his dedication to education. The molecular biology experience was directly useful, but his dedication to education was clear, but I felt it was not accepted as an Academy project as much as various scientific areas. One of the good things about the Academy is that it attracts imaginative people. And Bruce is an imaginative person. He's a hard-working person. And his interest in education has been very valuable in getting the Academy interested in that. So the president can influence the course of science in our society. What I'm a little surprised at now is that after 6 years as president, even though Bruce is still interested in education, his interests have turned to the international world, and he's trying to get the Academy to lead a similar organization in other countries and be more useful to their countries and the world. This is not an easy job to do, because there's so many. The other science societies are very different from ours. Our society is much more focused on doing things than honorable societies in other countries. Even I do appreciate the Royal Society. Does not excel in doing this.
So it's not so much to launch projects on global warming or international issues, but rather to get the Hungarian Academy of Sciences to behave differently,
right,
as it were.
And the Indian Academy of Sciences.
Those are no small tasks.
No small tasks. So, but this is interesting to me to observe that Bruce is now putting a major effort into this, because he feels this is something he can do that will be of general use to the world.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So this is what's going on. Mm.
On the education front, mm-hmm. Education is this vast inchoate sea.
Right.
How would you measure and evaluate the change that he's been able to make? I mean, has it been is this an unqualified success? Is this, or what? What are the words about it?
It's been a good attempt to change our educational system, but it has not been successful. It's not been successful because it's hard to change the people who are stakeholders, namely the elementary school teachers, the high school teachers, who have very strong position in our society, and they're not amenable to forward-looking changes. What the Academy has been able to do in this area, which I think is very important, is that the Academy has set up the idea of standards for each school and each grade, and that is finally being accepted, including in Massachusetts. And I think what it has done is made us realize that there were very few standards in education until recently, and now they are coming to be more useful.
Yeah. I watched that with interest, being brought up in a European system where everything is to a standard. Yeah.
Right. We never have that. I continue to be influenced by my work at Harvard, my work in the National Academy, my work at the Food and Drug Administration, which we haven't talked about, which we'll come to. But just in the last month or so, I've become very interested and aware of the importance of exposing pre-college students to science. And I am beginning a campaign in the National Academy to try and be helpful to students who have not been exposed to science, are too young to be exposed. And what this will end up as, I don't know, but what I have found is that the whole idea of trying to influence students at the lower grades has struck responsive chords in many people. And I'm hopeful that this will be something I can contribute to.
Can we go from the National Academy to the American Academy?
Yeah. The American Academy. I was elected a member at a young age. Much I was elected to the American Academy.
Okay.
Many years before.
I have the date here somewhere.
1954 or 55.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But this has always been a very sleepy organization. It's been an organization with no clear purpose, whereas the National Academy had the clear mandate to serve the government. The American Academy had the mandate to talk to itself. And as a result, even though there were good people in the Academy and it was considered an honor to be a member of the Academy, the Academy itself did little, if anything, to change our society or to support our society. I was actually asked to be treasurer while I was treasurer of the National Academy, and I told them I would not do that till I finished my term in the National Academy. And then I was elected treasurer and began to work with the American Academy. One of the pleasures of working with the American Academy was its new building, which was given by somebody I knew named Egan Land. And it's a beautiful building, but unfortunately it isn't occupied very much.
I'm a member of the American Academy, and I've never been there.
That's typical. The American Academy is an organization without a mission, is the way I would say it. And it isn't because it hasn't looked for a mission, but it hasn't been successful. The American Academy was founded much before the National Academy was founded.
A little after the American Philosophical
right.
Society, and in rivalrous
right.
response.
Right.
In the best American tradition.
But it has not been a successful organization except by being self-congratulatory. I'm always pleased to see how people enjoy being elected to the Academy, but I'm displeased to see that there hasn't been a sufficient number of members of the American Academy who could focus it on something or things our society needs. And it isn't because people haven't tried. One of the problems is that although it has a beautiful building, as a result of Tim Lyon's generosity, I should mention he was president of the Academy for a few years and then he became interested in it. But it hasn't been able to attract people who wanted to devote themselves to the American Academy.
Mm-hmm.
There's very little devotion, whereas with the National Academy, people are devoted.
Mm-hmm.
If you're asked to serve on a committee of the National Academy, even if you're a member, you almost always accept. But even if you're not a member, it's considered an honor. And I guess I should mention that you don't get paid for anything you do for the National Academy. You work for the honor.
If you were absolute dictator of the American Academy, what would you do?
simply try to find a mission. There isn't any attempt yet to find a meaningful mission. I think the people are in general content to just hear each other speak once a month. And there isn't financing enough. There's no money there to do the necessary things to make it meaningful. Its endowment is a tenth left of the National Academy, and the National Academy has the sponsorship of the government.
It's interesting, this is just an aside, but there are certain voluntary organizations, the National Academy in one way. I'm very aware right now of the Gordon Research Conferences, which have succeeded magnificently over time, because it is a mission that's defined, and people put huge amounts of volunteer effort into making it happen, and the contrast is very interesting.
What do you think could be the mission of the American Academy?
As a member, I would love it to have a mission, and I think one reason that I haven't thought about it this way, but one reason that I haven't gone is precisely that sense from a distance that this is a self-congratulatory talking shop, and I was honored to be elected.
That's it.
Well, we'll pursue that off the tape, but can I just go back to Harvard for a moment and say, you haven't really the School of Public Health, is there more to say in that
as I mentioned
territory?
I became affiliated with the School of Public Health as a result of Howard Hyatt being beaten, and because he got into what one might call quotes trouble, close quotes, with the faculty. And I was challenged by that fact, and when Howard suggested I be academic dean, I was ready to accept, and I did accept. I found the challenge of working with the faculty to be real, but I also found that the faculty were not appreciated by, for example, the medical school faculty, or were not appreciated outside of the world of public health. It was more an organization like the American Academy, which was self-congratulatory in the areas which it worked and did not really consider the larger missions it could have, and which are being developed and were initiated in part under Howard Hyatt's leadership, but more strongly now under new leadership we have with Barry Boone as the I think leadership is very important in life. I saw it at Polaroid with Ken Land. I saw it at Harvard with Derek Bach as president. In leadership, it doesn't come automatically to people when they have positions of leadership. That's what I've learned. Leadership can be very subtle and very frustrating, but if one has clear visions of what might result from the leadership, and it has a way of happening. And that occurred at Polaroid with the development of instant photography. Didn't have the vision. And it's beginning, and it could happen at the School of Public Health now.
What was your, how, your, you came into a very complicated, messy situation. Can you talk about what you brought to the party, and what difference there was by the time you left?
I brought to the party a clear sense of appreciation of the mission of the School of Public Health, the possible mission of the School of Public Health. And I brought to...
Namely?
Concern with health, not only in the United States, but throughout the world. And this is very complicated, is a very complicated area. Honey, are you ready for us?
Yes. Do you know what you'd like to drink? Coke, Diet Coke,
I'm just fine on water.
Water?
I think.
Ice water?
Yeah, that would be lovely.
Yeah. Yeah. But this question of leadership is intriguing me more and more.
His vision, I mean, vision alone won't do.
No, it won't. Howard had vision, which unfortunately he didn't have leadership. He had vision. He attracted people of intellect, but he couldn't make the school a force in the world.
Because the missing ingredient was what?
The missing ingredient was to get it. I can't answer that straight out. I can say, well, the mission is clear, ways of accomplishing the mission were not clear. If one could take a portion of the mission and find a country or countries where one could set example, then the mission could be accomplished. And finally, what was one needed was the same problem we had at the National Academy. You need financial backup to do anything in the world these days. You really need financial backup. I think you see this at the Chemical Heritage Foundation. I don't. Unless you have it, you're not going to make it as good as it could be.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes, sir.
And that's what a newbie, Barry Bloom, has the intellect to be the leader. But whether he can get the support that is necessary to be a leader, it isn't clear. Yet. It was very exciting being at the School of Public Health because it was, in a way, much less hidebound a place than the medical school. and one could try new things. For example, as academic dean, I saw the need in public health to emphasize the basic science, and I set up a division of biological sciences in the School of Public Health in an attempt to attract outstanding faculty, outstanding students, outstanding postdocs. And this division of biological sciences is now beginning to have a great influence, not only in the school, but folk outside. What we haven't been able to do, which nobody has done, is attract sufficient resources to the School of Public Health. See, the medical school has a big advantage. It teaches the people who treat people, and quotes grateful patients, close quotes, are a great source of wealth for the community.
Yes. So you succeeded in bringing in an awareness of basic science.
Right. Appreciation of it. In fact, it's now at the point where the Faculty of Arts and Sciences at Harvard now recognizes.
There's somebody over there.
Yeah, right.
You continued in that role to the age of 70. Was that the Harvard retiring age?
No,
or were you
just saying, Howard Ayotte had resigned as dean, and I didn't have the rapport with Harvey Feinberg. I had with Howard.
I just want to pause and characterize your different careers for a moment. Career number one was industrial researcher.
Right.
Career number two was an industrial researcher. To a first approximation, ended with Polaroid. And your second career was academic researcher. What termination date would you put upon that career? Has it terminated?
I'm still interested in research. I'm not doing as much research, but I'm still really interested. But you're right. And the industrial, the academic researcher, has allowed me to do things in the industrial sphere which I could not have done without the academic. For example, I have been the founding member of a new company called Enanta, E-N-A-N-T-A, and this company is now up and going. And pretty soon it's going to have products.
Play that story from the beginning. Where did it come from?
It started with three faculty members at the medical school came to me and said, "Elkin, we want to found a company. Will you help us? We don't have a clear idea what we want to do, but we do want to find and the cup.
When was that?
This was about 12 years ago. After thinking about it, I said I agree there's things that could be done. And we found a company which was called Novarex, because we thought we'd rely on do work in the area of viruses. After the company was founded, we struggled to find a place for the company. And we had not found the place when the scientific advisor suggested a new tack. This tack was making compounds for therapeutic purposes related to currently used compounds, but